Samuel chapter 20, for Samuel chapter 20. You know, I had about 6 years ago, I had LASIK surgery, and I went from, you know, having just great 2015 vision's been great, and they said about the 5-6 year mark, I might need some reading glasses for up close, and I'm right at that place where I use them now to study, but my Bible just kind of keeps sliding back farther and farther so I can read it. Oh, well. I'll need this in just a minute. Stay right there. Okay. Stay over there. Okay. Last week, we had talked about David fleeing from Saul and God kicking out all the different crutches he was leaning on, which left only God to be able to lean on. This week, David finds Jonathan and tells him of Saul's determination to kill him. Jonathan devises a plan to find out if this is true and to warn David. But last chapter, in chapter 19, especially at the end, David was singing himself out of the problem of faith. Matter of fact, we had said in Psalm 59 was the psalm that he wrote during that time of chapter 19. And that song ended, Psalm 59, and I'll read verse 16, "But I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning, for you have been my defense and my refuge in the day of my trouble." But the mere fact that he rejoiced in God has not relieved any of the pressures around his life. Indeed, his pressures have even intensified, even though he was just singing. He's going to emotionally cry out to Jonathan in chapter 20. And so we'll go from 19 being on a high to another low in chapter 20. And he cries out to Jonathan, "What have I done? Why did your dad want to kill me?" And so catch David's mood and his passion in his conversation in this next chapter. Even a man like David under pressure can come to a place where he doubts his friends and even doubts his God. Let's read. I've called this an arrow to the heart. Verse 1, chapter 20. "Then David fled from Naoth and Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?' So Jonathan said to him, 'By no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing either great or small without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so.' And David took an oath again and said, 'Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.' So Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you yourself desire, I'll do it for you.' And David said to Jonathan, 'Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, where there's yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he says thus, it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself. Why should you bring me to your father? But Jonathan said, far be it from you, for I know certainly that evil was determined, if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me, or what if your father answers you roughly? Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out into the field. And so both of them went out into the field." The problem, in spite of Jonathan's attempts to reassure him, David's convinced that Saul's still trying to kill him. Let me ask, are these symptoms found in your life today where you have the pressures of some situation or some circumstance or some trial that have brought you to doubt the promises of God? or the Word of God, or your purpose, His purpose for your life. This seems to be a natural progression that when a man begins to loosen his hold on the promise of God, he begins to lose his contact with spiritual friends. I've seen that a lot within the church where all of a sudden there's something hindering a relationship with their God. Next thing is to move away from church, move away from the good foundation of godly friends around themselves and start slipping back into the world. And it's that slow progress or slow regress, I guess. But it usually starts with the relationship with the Lord. A chill in our relationship with heaven is always found by or followed by a chill in our relationships down here. Its sheer pressure is absolutely overwhelming and throws us completely off balance until we learn the lesson that God has for us right in the middle of it. And it's way down in verse 10 where we realize that in David's question that Jonathan here showed greater faith in the promise of God than David at this point. This is a bummer chapter for David. It's a very grueling time. It's a very honest look at his soul and what he's troubled with. And again, it's amazing that it comes off chapter 19. The mountaintop experience, the excitement of doing it the right way and getting to the place to be able to rejoice and sing in God. And then in chapter 20, all the doubts come flowing in, and you need a good friend at the time for Jonathan to come alongside and reassure him of his own friendship and love, but also the promises of God that he can hold on to even during this dark time in his life. Now the promise in verses 12 through 17, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there's good towards David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth.' And so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies.' Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." Jonathan promises to warn David about his father's plan, whichever way it's going to go. And both men make the sacred vow to be loyal to each other at whatever the cost. Here's what Jonathan is doing, especially in verse 14 and 15 here. David worrying that he's not going to make it, that he's going to die. Jonathan actually switches that around and basically says, "No, you're probably going to be the one that makes it and not I. Matter of fact, you are going to be the one that makes it. I just don't know if I will or not," in which he doesn't. He ends up dying on the battlefield in chapter 31. But where Jonathan is coming from is this reminder of a promise that, remember, God is going to make you the next king. He's got plans for you. I'm not sure about the plan for me, but you are going to be around. And here's the covenant that we're going to have between each other here, is that for as long as I live, that you'll promise this covenant relationship with me, but not only myself, but the rest of my family. Why is he saying all of this? Well, because you know, the Eastern kings, as they would come in, number one thing to do is wipe out the other family. You don't want no boy, no relative, no cousins, somebody all of a sudden trying to usurp the throne, because it would usually be a succession through that family. But that wasn't God's will anymore, and even Jonathan knew that. That because of Saul's sin, he has taken it from his family and he's given it to this other family. That's ultimately why God is going to cut him off from Michal. That's why God's going to cut him off from Jonathan. And he's going to make him go it alone. Verse 14, I'm going to read it out of the ESV. It says, "If I am still alive," Jonathan speaking, "show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die." The steadfast love of the Lord. The New King James says the kindness of the Lord. But that the word kindness, steadfast love of the Lord. That's what I desire for you to show my family. That steadfast love is that royal love talked about by Paul in 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient and kind, and it's not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It doesn't demand its own way. It's not irritable, and it keeps no record of being wrong. It does not rejoice about injustice, like these injustices that are being brought about by his dad, Saul, to David. But in fact, rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up. Love never loses faith. It always is hopeful and endures through every circumstance. It doesn't fail. This promise of this oath is why in 2 Samuel, in chapter 9, it saves the life of Mephibosheth, one of his brothers, Jonathan's brothers, and who was lame in his feet. And because of this covenant to his family, that's why David not only didn't kill him, but brought him in to sit at his table and fed him and cared for him and took care of him the rest of his life. Let's look at their plan, what they come up with in 18 to 23. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon and you will be missed because your seat will be empty." Remember, they were based upon a lunar calendar, so they had less days. They only had 320 days of their year rather than the 365, because it was built on the lunar schedule rather than a solar schedule. And so then they would simply add a month for all those missing days. That's kind of how they did it. And so anytime there was a new moon, a new festival, new party that went on, and so he says, "Tomorrow's the new moon and you'll be missed, because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed and remain by the stone of Ezel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And there I'll send a lad saying, 'Go, find the arrows.' Now if I expressly say to the lad, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come,' then as the Lord lives, there's safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you, go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken, indeed the Lord will be between you and me forever.'" Speaking of their covenant, of God walking between them, holding both of their hands, walking through that cut sacrifice, like is explained in Deuteronomy there, God walking in between the sacrifice. May this happen to us get cut in half, if we break this covenant. That's the whole covenant thing that was going on there. And so his best friend says, "I'll shoot the arrows right next to you." That's a good friend. You better be accurate. You better be good. Okay, that's a trusting friend right there. "However, if they wing over your head, it's goodbye. Probably a goodbye until we meet in heaven." One of the best things that you can do in your own Bible study time, or if you're teaching Sunday school or teaching in any way, is put yourself in the character's shoes. What does he see? What does it smell like? How is he feeling? What's the hurts? What's the passion? What's going on in the story? So let's do that in this fateful moment and kind of step into David's life here. See, what's taking place is in just a matter of a few yards was going to decide David's future. If this arrow here, where did I chuck it? Here it is. If this arrow here, this is a homemade arrow brought back from Africa. If it's going to be just off to the side or in the back, that's going to be his whole future on where this thing lands. Either he'd get to go back into Saul's palace to the comfort of Jonathan's friendship, or to go into exile where he'd simply be at the mercy of God with not a friend in the world to be able to turn to. One of these ways was to be the God's path for David, the path that would eventually lead him to the throne of Israel. There's no doubt to David's preference. No doubt he would have chosen curtain number A, the arrow to fall by the side of him there, and to be able to go back to his friend, best friend Jonathan, back to his wife McCall in their home, his position to be reinstated in Saul's court and in Saul's army, to live in royalty. That surely was preferred to the alternative. Life in exile, a fugitive, an IDP, living out in the ruggedness of these unknown mountain ranges and caves, day after day, month after month, year after year. The decision, however, was out of David's hands completely. And don't you hate that? He only gets to stand by the stone of Azel in 19. You go right by this stone, and there he sits, or squats, or leans against, however big this stone of Azel is. But there he waits, all by himself, in the middle of this field, standing next to the stone, waiting for his fate. Wait for this arrow from heaven unerringly to hit the target. An arrow that would tell him either to go out into the wilderness or back into the palace of Saul. We can call this the stone of David's destiny, or the stone of departure. In the original Hebrew, out in the margin, it gave this definition, the stone that shapeth or showeth the way. That's when you sit and wait at Azel, you fully realize the decision is not in your hands. It's a scary place to be sometimes. Maybe it's a lesson that God is trying to teach you. Some area of your life where you're just waiting. It's hard to wait. And you find yourself at the same place as David this morning, simply sitting or standing at the stone of Azel. We remind ourselves that Jesus is our stone of destiny. Peter reminds us in 1 Peter 2:4, as you come to him, Jesus, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God is chosen and precious. He is that living stone that we go lean up against, and we wait for his call. We wait for his commission. We wait for his path. The burden of the pressure of circumstances, whatever it is, may be rolled away. You simply bring it and leave it at his feet. What else can you do? All you can do is what David did, and as he took his stand at his stone of destiny and simply waited. But it's actually a great thing to be in a position like that when all you can do is take your stand at Calvary and wait. So many paths, and naturally some far more attractive paths than others. But left to choose our own way, what fools we would make of ourselves if we didn't have one to direct us. I think all of us can look back at whatever age you got saved at. You simply look before that, and you look at your different paths that you took in different areas of your life, different choosings where you specifically chose it and said, I will try the pathway of sexual immorality. I'll try this pathway of drinking. I'll try this pathway of drugs. I'll try this pathway of whatever it was. It's kind of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, where the whole chapter is Solomon with all the money of the world, all the women of the world, all the everything, servants, musicians, everything. And he went down every one of those streets to its fullest, more than any man ever did, and found it a dead end at the end of every single one of those roads. There's only one way that leads to the throne, and that is God's plan for your life and for mine. Folks, he brings every one of us to the stone of Azel and causes us to wait, and causes us to wait to hear his path, the one path to the throne for each of our lives. And so therefore we can stand still and see the salvation of our God. We can wait. The decision is beyond you, and the battle is not yours, it's God's. Let him decide. You simply need to hide in his wounded side. Our next section from 24 to the end of the chapter is the confirmation of David's fears. I really don't know why Jonathan wouldn't believe him when back in chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told Jonathan, I want to kill David. It seemed to make it pretty clear. But he's like, no, he just said that. You know, he was blowing off some hot steam. But now it gets confirmed for Jonathan also. Verse 24, David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat at his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. That means you're nervous. You always want to watch the entrance. A lot of guys do this. You want to make sure you never sit in front of a window or with your back to the door. Make sure your back is against so you can watch everything at hand, be able to protect your wife, family, whoever's there. Guys often take this position. There's Saul doing the same. Verse 25. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, in a seat by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought something has happened to him. He's unclean. Surely he is unclean. Ceremonially unclean. If you touched a dead animal accidentally, if you had sexual intercourse with your wife, there's a number of things laid out in Leviticus that would make you unclean for one day. Remember that. Verse 27, and then it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, and Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either yesterday or today? Okay, I get it yesterday, didn't even say anything, maybe he got defiled, no big deal, that happens. But day two, now I'm going to ask. Verse 28, so Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem, and he said, please let me go. For our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, that he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives in the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? And King Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. Yeah, you got it now? Wow. Verse 34, so Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him, that he said to the lad, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. As the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And the lad had come to the place where the arrow was with which Jonathan had shot. Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? That's his code to David. Verse 38, and Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows, came back to his master, but the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of this matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad and said to him, go, carry them to the city. As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place towards the south, fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times, and they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever. So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. And so Saul notices David's lack of presence at the meal, and Jonathan makes up this excuse that David had gone to Bethlehem to do this family sacrifice. Wow, in verse 30 there, these words out of Saul's lips to his son Jonathan, the lowest of lows, had to sting. Basically, he was saying to him, you are not my son at all. For my son wouldn't betray me like this. Therefore, Jonathan, you're slandering your own mother. You're not my son. So you're saying your mother slept with some other guy? That's what's coming down here. You're not my son. You must be illegitimate. What terrible words. Maybe some of you endured some sharp and abusive words growing up. Maybe they came flying out of your mouth to your own children. A fit of rage, that anger to say something where it just comes flying out. That's sad. David and Jonathan lied to Saul, and it almost cost Jonathan his life. This is a lie. Flat out lie. He's hiding out in the field And he's lying, saying he went to Bethlehem. David came up with it. The man after God's own heart, yeah. David came up with it. Jonathan went along with it. And it almost cost him his life. A man after God's own heart does not mean he's perfect and never made a mistake. His life, his thoughts, his heart, his life engulfed following after his God doesn't mean he didn't do some stupid things. This would be an example of coming up with a lie. Not listening maybe for a different way of escape or hearing from God in a different way of coming up with that. And so we don't want to whitewash that in any way. Bad decision almost caused him his life here. It has been well said, faith is living without scheming. In the midst of the trials of life, we must be aware lest we become weary and stop trusting and start scheming. It's very easy to do. We don't call it a lie. We can come up with other words to be able to kind of cushion it. We'll call it scheming or whatever. White lies. But right now, you can judge David, or perhaps you've schemed your way out of a situation or two before. So it's easy to kind of just hang this one on him, and I'd simply say, look in the mirror, because you've schemed also. Furious Saul not only states his intention to kill David, but actually attempts to murder Jonathan for just befriending him. You know what got me is in verse 34. Jonathan gets up from the table after all that just interaction with his dad there. His dad saying those pretty harsh words. Not only that, throwing the spear right at his head and sticking in the wall. He's saying, I'm out of there. He fasts the rest of the day. It's a day of feasting. He says, I'm not going to eat. I don't feel like eating because I'm grieving for my friend David. And I say, really? Not grieving that your dad just chucked a spear at your head and called you a son of a perverse, rebellious woman? But there's friendship right there. Not worrying about any of that. He'll deal with that later, I guess, emotionally or mentally or whatever else. But that deep friendship, it says he walks away grieving the rest of the day because of the loss of friendship for his friend David. Well, Jonathan's pretty convinced now, and so with a heavy heart, he takes his lad and takes his arrows and goes outside to fulfill the rest of this and shoot the arrows. And so according to their plan, he goes out there and be able to meet with them this last time, affirm his loyalty, and say goodbye to one another before he leaves. But these arrows weren't from Jonathan's hand alone, and David knew it. Jonathan just being the instrument of letting go of the arrows, God was going to direct those arrows. They went beyond David. Goodbye until we meet in glory. That's what it represented. Is not the arrow behind you? Shouted Jonathan. Meaning this is it. So we picture David now crouching down behind the rock of Azel, waiting, anticipating his destiny hanging in the balance, whether he would hear that arrow to the bushes off to the right or left, or if it's going to whizzing past his head. Waiting, 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 and then the launch. And if this was a movie, it'd be slow motion, going over, just waiting in all of his destiny, awaiting that moment and anticipating that. And it arches right over him, lands behind him. Well, what are your feelings doing at that point, seeing that this isn't just Jonathan, this is a God thing? All of a sudden, your future just flashing before you. What is the message to the heart? What is the Lord? He knew it meant the Lord sending him away. It wasn't left to chance. This is the will of God. In fact, the arrow was shot by the very hand of God. And behind its flight was the loving purpose of God for his harassed child. If David dared to linger now after this word from heaven, he'd lose his life. He'd lose his crown. He'd lose his everything God had for him. David's life was being emptied from vessel to vessel like wine in order to preserve its freshness and keep it from going musty. Out of the palace, to McCall's household, friendship with David, losing each one of these crutches, each one of these props that were propping him up, each one being taken away. And he must stand alone, and yet never alone. Before him lay the rugged mountains and dark valleys with no promise of relief from the pressure. Behind him, the comfort of friendship, of human love, of home, of restoration, of honor. Now, nothing but God. But we place the emphasis on but God. Certainly the hardest thing of all is to lose the crutch of Jonathan's love. They do get to meet one more time in chapter 23 and verse 16. David was hiding in some caves and had the interaction with Saul from a distance. It says, then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. That would be their last meeting. He dies after that. His two friends cut asunder in the sovereignty of God. Here is two best friends, loved each other incredibly, that God pulls out his sovereign sword and cuts this relationship in half and says no more. Why would God do something like that? Somebody that is such an encouragement to you, a godly encouragement to you, except I've seen it in my life. You've probably seen it in your life. Probably still asking the question why. I am, with some of them, dear godly friends, to be cut off, and I don't have the answer. But he obviously does that at times. Again, in the big picture of things, God had to remove the throne from Saul and all of his family. That was the promise. That was the judgment upon his head. It now has to move to David, the line of Judah. The Messiah would come, and all the inner workings. It was about the crown. It was about Messiah. It was about all of that. And this would be part of the suffering that would have to take place. Part of his cross to be able to bear to get to the crown. We don't always get all the answers, but they'll be answered one day. Friendships. Friendships are important, though. And even this, though this is a story of having to go it with God alone, this doesn't dismiss friends. This doesn't mean go home and cut off all your friendships and you think you're going to be all spiritual and all holy to say it's just me and God, that's all I need. No. There's friendships all throughout the Bible. It's just this time, just this place, just this purpose. We need our friends. Jesus needed friends. He's going to the most difficult time in all of his life in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he brings his 11 buddies with him. Come pray with me. Come pray for me. And he brings them with him. Paul, wrapping up Romans chapter 16, names 27 friends by name and what they did and what they did for the church and everything else just in that one little chapter of Romans 16. It's beautiful. Friendships, important. Back in the early 70s, the UCLA football team suffered through a very poor season. The coach, Pepper Rogers, came under intense criticism and pressure, as coaches do, from alumni, from fans. Things got so bad, he remembers with a smile that friends became hard to find. He said, "My dog was my only true friend," Rogers says of that year. "I told my wife that every man needs at least two good friends, and she went out and bought me another dog," he said. I love that story. Yeah, we need friends. But there are times where he wants us to go it alone. There are times for the Paul to say, "I want you in Saudi Arabia for 3 years, it's just me and you." But he went on to have many friends. Let these arrows go winging over your head this morning. First from Luke 9:23 arrow. "If any would come after me," anyone would come after me, "must deny himself and take up his cross daily," every day, "and follow me." That's one of the arrows that goes flying over every one of our heads. Arrow number two in Matthew 10:37, "Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Another arrow goes flying over our heads. Luke 14:33, the third arrow, "Any of you does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple." That doesn't make you more holy to give everything away. No, what happens is if we come to him with open hand and hand him everything that we have, he usually gives about 90% of it back to us anyways. He's saying just don't hold a tight grip to everything. There's some that he requires. I need to take everything away because you were trusting too much in them. You're holding too tightly to the material things in this world. And so some, he needs to take them away. But others, it's not that way with everyone. And so when he says that, anyone does not give up everything, that means give it up with open hand. Doesn't necessarily mean give it all away. Let me wrap up with just a couple statements here. The message of the arrow beyond you is not primarily geographical. It is spiritual. As I said in the very beginning, we're called to live sacramentally like broken bread and poured out wine. Let God empty you out that he may save you from becoming spiritually stale to lead you ever onward. He's always calling us to pass beyond the thing we know into the unknown. Remember, a throne is God's purpose for you, a cross is God's path for you, and faith is God's plan for you. So he has a plan. It's going to be through the cross to get us to the crown. He does that for every single believer. He started it with Jesus Christ himself. He's our role model, and that's where it is. This morning, if you find yourself crouching next to the stone of Azel, and waiting, anticipating, looking up, listening for the arrow, the fear of the unknown, the fear of the future, and the fear of those things, wait upon God. Let's pray.